Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
If you start with the premise that war is hell, it's easy to understand why counting the pennies is so hard. But get enough of those pennies together, and it's real money. The president gave a big speech today on the war on terror. The House continued its debate on Iraq. And the Senate wants to count the pennies better. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Duke Executive MBA, developing leaders and accelerating careers around the world with four top-ranked executive MBA programs for working professionals. More at DukeExecutiveMBA.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Online at Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's February 15th today. Great to have you with us on this Thursday. Politics is often referred to as a horse race, and there was a trifecta of sorts today up on Capitol Hill. Auditors of the three main agencies responsible for keeping track of Iraq reconstruction money were at the witness table. You might be able to guess how things went during the hearing today by the House Government Reform Committee. About $10 billion in Pentagon and State Department spending has been wasted or not properly accounted for, a number that could grow, one of the auditors said, with the president's plans to send more troops. The House hearings provided a perfect launchpad for new contracting legislation introduced today over in the Senate. Eric Kneeler has more now from Washington.
Democratic Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts doesn't mince words when it comes to some U.S. firms doing work in Iraq.
Shady battlefield contracting. Contractors who are not interested in getting the troops what they need at the lowest cost possible or helping to save taxpayer dollars. Contractors who just want to walk away with as much as they can for themselves.
Kerry and fellow Democrats introduced legislation today that would toughen federal contracting rules. The bill boosts penalties for so-called war profiteers who overcharge the government. It also requires more competitive bidding, prohibits political cronies from overseeing contracting agencies, and bans companies who show a pattern of cheating from getting more contracts. Senator Byron Dorgan of North Dakota is a co-sponsor.
There have been circumstances where on the same day in a criminal court in one of Virginia's suburbs, the same company was defending itself against criminal charges, and in the Pentagon, it was signing a new contract.
But critics say contractors need flexibility in war zones, not more rules. Stan Soloway of the Professional Services Council says real reforms should go beyond the blame game.
There's huge underlying personnel policy issues that they're totally being ignored here in favor of sort of a polemic attack on contractors, many of whom are living and dying in harm's way.
The bill has no Republican co-sponsors. If passed, it would only apply to future government contracts. In Washington, I'm Eric Kneeler for Marketplace.
Let's see if you can follow the bouncing ball with me on this one. Last year, a company called Dubai Ports World tried to buy an English firm that controlled operations at six big seaports in the U.S. American politicians raised all kinds of cane about an Arab-owned company running things at six big seaports in the U.S. So Dubai Ports World agreed to sell off its operations at those six big seaports in the U.S. to the global insurance giant AIG. Today, it appears Dubai Ports is having a hard time following through. From New York, Marketplace's Amy Scott ties up the loose ends.
DP World can't officially sell its New York and New Jersey operations to AIG Global Investment Group until the Port Authority gives its consent. But the companies say the Port Authority won't approve the deal until they pay a fee of up to $84 million. In a letter to the Port Authority today, executives said they were unaware of such a fee at any other port in the world and called it far in excess of any reasonable administrative fee. Michael Moore is a senior vice president at DP World. He says the holdup is especially frustrating because the company didn't want to sell its U.S. terminals in the first place.
We weren't leaving the U.S. of our own volition. We were leaving the United States because we were asked to. The irony is now we're having a hard time leaving.
The Port Authority says it's ready to go back to the bargaining table anytime. Spokesman Steven Sigmund says the authority invested $30 million in the terminal that AIG would be taking over. It wants its share of the profits from that investment.
We are looking to make sure, one, that those investments don't just walk away through the profits that this company is making by selling the asset for a lot of money. And two, asking the AIG to make long-term capital investments so that we know that there'll be a, long-term partner.
The companies have an unlikely ally. U.S. Senator Charles Schumer of New York was among DP World's fiercest critics when it appeared an Arab company would be running a major U.S. port terminal. Today, the senator called the Port Authority's price greedy and asked officials to approve the sale. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
If you go to the Starbucks website, it tells you coffee as a drink originated in Ethiopia more than 1,000 years ago. And right about here is where irony meets the news of the day. Ethiopia has been trying to trademark some of its beans. Starbucks has been accused of blocking that process. And today, a group of major African coffee-growing countries took sides. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has more.
A group representing Africa's top coffee growers today attacked Starbucks. It urged the company to drop its opposition to Ethiopia's campaign to trademark some of its coffees in the United States. The British charity Oxfam has endorsed that trademark campaign. Oxfam's Chris Jocknick says it'll bring vital help to a country where most people live on less than $2 a day.
What this initiative tries to do is to give those farmers the leverage to control and manage the names of their coffees in order to be able to derive more value from the sale of those coffees.
Starbucks denies that it's tried to block Ethiopia's trademark applications, but the company's Sandra Taylor says Starbucks does not believe that trademarking is the best way for the Ethiopians to improve their standard of living.
Well, we respect the Ethiopian government's right to choose the direction that works for them. For us, we believe it's most important for farmers to focus on quality, and that's why we have undertaken the kinds of programs we've announced for East Africa.
Starbucks is planning a support center to advise coffee farmers on how to improve the quality of their beans, and the company's putting more money into health, education, and water projects. Entirely laudable, says Oxfam, but the group says it would be much better to let the farmers trademark their produce, giving them more control over the price and more earning power. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke had some more nice things to say about the economy today. That had the effect you might imagine it would on investors. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Discount airline JetBlue is doing what it can to make amends today, if there's a way to make sitting on an airport tarmac for 11 hours less painful. Some JetBlue passengers at New York's Kennedy Airport wound up doing just that yesterday. The big snow and ice storm that moved through the East Coast forced carriers to cancel hundreds of flights. JetBlue is saying what happened to some of its passengers was unacceptable. It's going to offer free flights and refunds to soothe ruffled feathers, and CEO Dave Neilman said today it could cost the company millions of dollars. But commentator Christopher Elliott says, unfortunately, JetBlue's the exception, not the rule.
You'd think that the airlines would be ticked off at Mother Nature right about now. All that bad weather, all those delays. The exact opposite is probably true, though. They're relieved. See, the airline's legal agreement between them and you, it's called the contract of carriage, says if weather prevents or delays one of their flights, they're off the hook. Airlines aren't required to offer passengers any of the compensation they would for a mechanical delay, things like phone cards, meal vouchers, or hotel rooms. But I think airlines are too quick to play the weather card. For example, if fog keeps your plane from taking off or landing at an airport where you're making a connection, they consider that a weather delay, too. I don't. I never asked to be routed through Dallas or Denver. It's the major airlines and their hub and spoke system that forces me to visit. If my connecting flight is delayed, for whatever reason, I think the airline should assume some responsibility for its scheduling decision and lend a hand. It's a contract loophole that a 747 could fly through, and I think it's time to close it. Airlines should take care of their passengers during these weather delays just as they do when there's an operational snafu. Now, granted, that may seem bad for business, at least in the short term, but it's good and responsible customer service. And in an industry where passengers draw little distinction between one carrier and the next, good customer service is what may set a profitable airline apart from a loser.
Christopher Elliott's the ombudsman at National Geographic Traveler magazine. Share your thoughts with us through our website. Marketplace.org is the address. Hugo Chavez is broadening his ambitions. The president of Venezuela has already nationalized what he calls strategic parts of that economy. Earlier this week, the government bought out local subsidiaries of some big American companies, telecommunications and electricity firms. Now it's food. It's been weeks since most stores have had beef on the shelves. Staples like sugar and rice have been cleared out. Chavez said yesterday he suspects supermarkets and distribution centers are hoarding supplies rather than sell at the government's fixed prices, and he threatened to nationalize them, too. From the Marketplace America's desk at WLRN via Caracas, Dan Gretsch reports now the shortages might be a case of political supply and demand.
Before sunrise above the mountains that ring Caracas, Minerva Simosa takes her place in line. She patiently waits to enter the Mega Mercado, a giant outdoor market set up by the Venezuelan government to sell subsidized food.
The people are here to buy the chicken and milk they can't find in the store, and for the sugar, of course.
This is the first Mega Mercado in nearly 3 months, and a food line of this magnitude is the last thing you'd expect to see in one of the world's most oil-rich nations. The line wraps around a dirt soccer field, crosses a street, circles a park, and ends a mile later with three men in military uniforms holding guns. Songs praising President Chavez blare on loudspeakers. Eight hours later, Simosa's finally able to buy her ration of food. Two frozen chickens, 2 kilos of sugar, and a bag of powdered milk. The vendors have run out of cooking oil and butter. Still, Simosa's pleased.
Yesterday, I bought a chicken in the supermarket and it cost me $7. Today, I bought 2 chickens for half that much. As much as you save, it's worth the wait. These mega mercados are the best thing the government can do.
Despite the long wait, Simosa's a die-hard supporter of Chavez, the man who introduced sweeping socialist reforms to this nation of 26 million people. Along with the mega mercados, he pays people to attend school. He opens factories in slums. He offers free health care.
Thank you from the bottom of my heart to our president, Hugo Rafael Chavez Frias. He's the only president that has given these benefits to us as a group, not to individuals.
In 2002, Chavez began freezing the prices of basic goods like beef, sugar, and coffee. Since then, Venezuela has seen an overall inflation of 100%, the highest rate in the hemisphere. But because the prices of staples are fixed, the poor, who spend about half their income on food, have been largely insulated from this rampant inflation. Cheap eats go a long way to explain why Chavez has a 70% approval rating among the poor. It also explains the shortages. Farmers say they can no longer afford to sell beef or sugar or milk at the subsidized prices. Farms are shutting down or selling their products on the black market. Part of Chavez's novel approach is insisting his ministers mix with the masses. Here, back at the Mega Mercado, the Minister of Nourishment, a new cabinet position created by Chavez, holds a press conference. He recognizes the crowd is growing restless. He offers a bureaucratic explanation for the food shortages.
In reality, there's a logistical problem in the network of distribution of food. It's very technical, not worth specifying the problem, but we'll fix them by next week.
Newspaper reporter Gabriela Ibarren is recording the minister's remarks. The whole time, she's eyeing a large packet of sugar near the microphone. As the press conference ends, she asks the minister if she can have the sugar. He says yes.
I don't have any sugar in my house. I always take the sugar after these press conferences. I tell them it's for my kids, and they give it to me.
Next up, Venezuela's vice president, Jorge Rodriguez, makes an appearance. He wades through the crowd. People cheer, touch his arm, call out requests. The vice president talks briefly with a woman. Then he gestures for his assistant to take down her number. As Rodriguez presses ahead, the crowd shifts from adulation to anger. Sweat pours down the vice president's face as he explains to me why he's braving this crowd.
It's a policy of President Chavez to be in contact with the people, face to face, to listen to their needs and their problems. We do this much more often than in the past.
As prices march implacably upwards, the shortages on price-fixed food will inevitably get worse, and it might take more than a vice presidential visit to placate this swarming crowd. In Caracas, I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Coming up, some tough questions for the healthcare business.
Should we be paying a manager 1,000 times as much as a neurosurgeon?
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials crescendoed 23 points today, 0.2% to finish at a record high of 12,765. The Nasdaq swelled 8 points, 0.3% to close at 2,497. The S&P 500 scaled up 1 point, that's about 0.1% to end at 1,456. There was some very good news brewing for Anheuser-Busch. The beverage mogul is in merger talks with Belgium-based beer giant InBev. It makes Stella Artois. Anheuser's shares hopped up 3% today. The silver bullet was going great guns as well. Shares of Molson Coors Brewing Company shot up 5.5% thanks to effervescent sales last quarter. Splitting your jeans can be a good thing after all. Sales at Guess have been riding high, and shares hiked up 12% after the denim dynamo okayed a stock split. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.71%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, supporting the role that an experienced financial advisor can play in building a well-rounded financial program. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Want to hear something on Marketplace again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and additional special features, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just head over to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on new home construction for January. The Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee discusses the rising cost of higher education. And something for the birds, the annual Great Backyard Bird Count begins. Observers count species and report on their numbers, providing a record for scientists to track how our feathered friends are doing as their environments change. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl, and it's time now for the business of sports. We're in what you might call the big-time sports dead zone. Football's over. Spring training hasn't really started yet. Yes, the NBA's All-Star game is this weekend, but that's not a real game anyway. So what about soccer? Owners of some big-time American sports franchises are betting heavily on English football, as they call it over there. And our business of sports analyst, Ed Dursey, has more. Hey, Ed.
Hey, Kai.
This is a subject you know a little something about.
Yes, by way of full disclosure, Fox Sports International, for whom I work, is the broadcaster of the English Premier League in the United States.
So we have these American team owners who are going over to England, buying up brand-name teams. Who are these guys, and why are they doing it?
Three teams within the last 2 years have been purchased by American owners. Malcolm Glazer 2 years ago bought Manchester United for $1.4 billion. And then last year, Randy Lerner, who owns the Cleveland Browns, bought Birmingham club Aston Villa for $122 million. And then most recently last week, George Gillette and Tom Hicks of the Montreal Canadiens, Dallas Stars, and Texas Rangers fame bought a controlling interest in Liverpool for $340 million. And I think you'll actually see more of this happen.
Well, here's the $64,000 question, though. Why?
They're a good value right now compared to American clubs. The U.S. market is tough to get into. $340 million for one of the top teams in the league is, you know, actually a relatively cheap price. Yeah. The English Premier League just signed a huge new TV deal, $4.5 billion over the next 3 years, and $1.2 billion of that is for international rights. And then the sort of guts of the teams themselves really lend themselves to a revision or modernizing. Liverpool, for example, plays in a stadium that was built in 1884. Hmm. Can you imagine any American team doing that? So things like naming rights and concessions, you know, if you've ever tried to get a meat pie and a beer at Highbury, you'll know what I'm talking about. And then, of course, there's the real estate potential in things like skyboxes. And, of course, there's great tradition for these teams. They have loyal worldwide fans. You know, all of this sort of Commonwealth dissemination that's occurred over 100 years spreads the game worldwide.
I think the phrase actually is upside potential. Right.
Yeah. And really, in the end, this is not about England itself. This is really about globalization and the globalization of sport. And soccer really is the world's global game. And the English Premier League is soccer's sort of most high profile and popular league.
How are these guys being accepted when they go over there with their checkbooks open? I mean, if you recall, and I'm sure you do, Malcolm Glazer was, I think, burned in effigy.
Yes, he was burned in effigy. And the fans of Manchester United opposed him vociferously. However, now that Manchester United is sitting on the top of the English Premier League with a very hefty record and comfortable margin, suddenly the cries of protest have died down among the fans. And actually, for Gillette and Hicks, they've been welcomed with relatively open arms because Liverpool is a relatively underfunded club. And what the fans want is to win. And, you know, they want a new stadium and they want to see the amenities that the big clubs have.
Let me ask you this, though. How much of what's happening with soccer is these guys who are deeply involved in big American sports realizing that that model, the American model, doesn't really translate globally?
Well, I think the American business model translates, and that's the bet that these guys are making. What doesn't export are the sports themselves. So the NFL, Major League Baseball, World Baseball Classic aside, they're not really global sports. The NHL, you need ice, doesn't fly in South America and in Africa. And NASCAR, you've already got Formula One. Soccer is the global sport, and these guys realize that these teams, these top teams in the English Premier League, can become global brands, and that's what they're trying to do.
Ed Dursey is the Vice President of Interactive Media at Fox Sports International. When he does the business of sports for us, it's his opinion, not theirs. Ed, thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Kai.
Healthcare in this country eats up 16% of gross domestic product. Last year, that came to more than $2 trillion, which raises this question. Where does all the money go? We've started to take a regular look at that. Last month, we told you hospitals gobble up about a third of it, but other parts of the system aren't exactly cheap either. For example, healthcare CEOs get a lot of flack for what they get to take home. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WGBH, Helen Palmer looks at whether the bosses are worth what they get.
If you suspect that just maybe some healthcare CEOs are getting extremely lucrative deals, let me mention a name. William Maguire, ex-CEO of United Health Group.
His $1.8 billion in embedded options is certainly a record breaker.
Paul Hodgson of the Corporate Library, which studies pay and governance. Maguire's actual salary, before all those stock options, was mere millions. But overall, Paul Hodgson says insurance company CEOs aren't exactly hurting compared with their peers.
The median total compensation for chief executives was just under $7 million. But for the executives in the insurance industry, it was almost $11 million.
Hodgson says that pharmaceutical companies pay their CEOs pretty well too, an average annual salary of nearly $9 million, not counting stock options. Management experts say that gold-plated CEO salaries are justified. Sri Prakash Kothari heads the MIT Sloan School's finance department.
If you want to attract top talent, then you have to pay salaries that are commanded by top talent.
Or, as Michael Douglas put it more baldly a couple of decades ago,
greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works.
Well, if not greed, then perhaps ambition. Qatari says 70,000 MBAs graduate in the USA every year. A mere handful become CEOs. Healthcare CEOs head up businesses that employ thousands. The pay and perks reflect the responsibility and the competition.
These are exceptionally talented individuals. They put in long hours for 20, 25 years before becoming a CEO. The tenure of a CEO is fairly short these days.
Qatari says CEOs are paid for performance. But Harvard Business School's Regina Herzlinger says the link between pay and performance is often pretty weak in healthcare. Take the drug industry, Herzlinger says.
How many important new drugs are you bringing to the market that will make people have better and more productive lives? They have a very poor pipeline, and yet they earn tens of millions of dollars.
Herzlinger says some CEOs pocket hefty payouts even while delivering lousy shareholder value. Merck and Pfizer both saw the stock drop around 40%, yet their ex-CEOs still walked away with tens of millions of dollars. United Health got a better deal. Under William Maguire, the company's revenues more than tripled, making his payout, well, modest. Paul Hodgson of the Corporate Library.
United Health is such an enormous organization that even the $1.8 billion that Maguire holds in stock options would represent only about 4% of annual revenues.
Still, some stakeholders question exactly what value a healthcare CEO delivers, compared with, say, a skilled heart or brain surgeon. David Himmelstein's a professor at Harvard Medical School.
Should we be paying a manager 1,000 times as much as a neurosurgeon? My answer would be no.
Medicare, Medicaid, the VA, teachers, firefighters, the taxpayer picks up about 60% of the U.S. healthcare tab. Himmelstein asks, should health CEOs really pocket so much?
United Healthcare is the biggest seller of Medicare Part D policies, for instance. Why should their CEO make $50 million a year when the President of the United States settles for $400,000 a year?
CEO compensation's now getting closer scrutiny from boards and shareholders. And there's evidence the coming proxy season will show that pay's rising more slowly. Nobody's calculated exactly how much of the U.S. healthcare bill goes into the pockets of CEOs. It's probably only about 2%. But since U.S. healthcare is the size of the GDP of China, that's around $50 billion. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, they've held them for hunger, human rights, and disaster aid. Now climate change is the latest issue to rock out for. Former Vice President Al Gore announced a series of worldwide concerts today to raise awareness of the Earth's rising temperature. It's a 24-hour event dubbed Live Earth to be held July 7th. It's part of what's being called a campaign for a climate in crisis. More than 100 musicians, everybody from Bon Jovi to the Black Eyed Peas, will perform on seven continents. No word yet on ticket prices. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow zippity-doo-dah up 23 points, 0.2% for yet another record close at 12,765. The NASDAQ gained 8 points, 0.3%. The S&P 500 picked up 1 point. That's about 0.1%. Our editors include John Buckley, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, Stacey Bannock-Smith, and Lisa Tucker. If you happen to miss the show on the air, we're podcasting. You can check out the link at our website. It's marketplace.org. Next time on the air, New York's bridges and tunnels. Look for sponsors.
What are we going to do, rename the Church Avenue station after Citigroup? How about rename the Lincoln Tunnel after Waste Management or the Holland Tunnel after Monsanto?
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.